Welcome to the Songs of Note podcast, where we talk about the songs we love and the stories behind them. I'm your host, Ryan Gregg. Thank you so much for listening today. I am thrilled to have Colin Fleming back on the show. He has been on five times before, talking about Joy Division, The Doors, Billie Holiday. So if you enjoy this interview and you haven't heard those other shows, please go back and check them out and see if you like them. If you are joining us for the first time or joining and you haven't subscribed yet, be sure and subscribe so you don't miss an episode. Doing these episodes about once a week, and love getting to talk music with people about songs that I love and I hope that you love as well. If you want to send me an email, if you have like requests for songs that you'd like to hear stories about, you can email me. My email is thesongsofnote@gmail.com. If you're enjoying the show, if you want to write a review on iTunes or whatever platform you're listening to, that's always helpful as well, because that gets the show in front of more people. But today we have Colin Fleming as a guest. I'm going to put links to his Twitter and his website in the show notes, because I just think the world of him. He's such a great music critic and music buff. He knows his stuff. So I love talking with him. And we're going to head on over to the interview with him right now. Here we go. All right. Well, today I'm excited to be talking with Colin. We've got Colin Fleming. Colin, this is your sixth time on the show. Man, I'm so, so grateful that you are willing to come on and talk some more music with me. Thank you for joining us today.
Half dozen. Am I the league leader?
You are the leader. Yes.
All right. Top of the charts, baby.
That's right. That's right. Well, you know what? I mentioned the last week's episode that This is no bragging rights, except to say that I'm thrilled that people have listened to the show more than 10,000 times, and that's just a huge honor. And a lot of that has to do with you being a guest on here. So I'm grateful for you being willing to continue to talk and talk music with me.
I did see that number. I was actually thinking about that number on my run. I meant to bring that up with you. That's a lot, and it's only been since what? Since like November? Yeah, am I making that?
Yeah, November's right. Yeah,
but not that
you.
Long.
Yeah, thanks. It's been fun, and you know, and I do want to mention that I took a break there for at least a month, maybe two, and you were the one that kind of reached out. I was like, yeah, let's get this going. Let's do another talk. And so I want to thank you for that as well, because you kind of helped me get back on the saddle when I was in the COVID break.
You and your COVID doldrum.
so thank you. But today we're talking about Led Zeppelin. We have not talked about Led Zeppelin yet on the show, and you and I were talking about what's a good song to talk about. And When the Levee Breaks got brought up, and it's one of my favorite Zeppelin songs. And I didn't know the background behind the song and who originally wrote it until I started researching this episode. So what's kind of the background on this song? Do you want to talk about when it was written and who wrote it?
It's a pretty safe assumption. Now, I'm going to have some very mixed thoughts on Led Zeppelin, but it's a pretty safe assumption with Led Zeppelin that it came from someone before them. And they don't cover songs, really, like
true.
The Rolling Stones would do.
Yeah.
They take what they want to have.
Yes.
Like, now it is ours.
Right.
That's sort of one of the, to me, crucial problems. There are many with Led Zeppelin. Now, Led Zeppelin is a group that I got into like pretty early, and I like them. But I think there's a big difference between maybe liking something and how good something actually in itself is. Mm. So I know all the bootlegs, know all the music, and I sound like someone who's like, wow, this guy's all about Led Zeppelin. But I also have some serious reservations about them. But the background for this song is, it's a flood, essentially, right? Now,
right.
I think when you start listening to Led Zeppelin 4, and there are all these, like, sort of, you can get it with Led Zeppelin 2, where there's, like, this Tolkien-type stuff, there's this fantastical element. And it's very romantic when you're like 15, you're 16, right? That's when people get into Led Zeppelin. And I would argue that they're kind of like a 15-year-old's idea of a perfect band.
Hmm.
And then we kind of leave that behind and we move on to other things.
Yeah.
But When the Levee Breaks, even as a title, when you're 15, 16, it sounds so romantic, but you don't know what it's about, right? It sounds like almost like science fiction. Like, it's not within your mid-teen world. And I think that's exciting. But the source material was the Mississippi flood of 1927. So this would have been prime subject matter if you were a Delta blues artist, right, like Memphis Minnie, who was married to a guy named Kansas Joe McCoy. And they recorded the original version of When the Levee Breaks. Now, that's where most of our lyrics are going to come from with the Zeppelin version in 1929. Mm. So you have this flood, like this kind of American biblical event, sweep through this Noah's Ark type of deal, wreck the place, and people are trying to rebuild their lives. It's almost like they're Katrina in a way, right? And so there are various blues songs that came out from this time period. Bessie Smith had one. The very underrated and coolly named Barbecue Bob had one called Mississippi Heavy Water Blues. But I think this one is kind of the go-to for Mississippi flood songs. Now, Charlie and Minnie were married, and he sings the song and plays rhythm guitar. And she plays lead guitar, and she is a phenomenal guitar player.
She is.
And Zeppelin knew this. Yeah, I mean, she's a better guitarist. I don't think, like, it's really that close than actually Jimmy Page is. If you listen to her,
it's fantastic.
You go on YouTube. Yeah, if you listen to her, and she's not, like, soloing, because if people know Mississippi Delta blues, there aren't really guitar solos. Like, Robert Johnson, he doesn't solo.
Right.
So it's almost like you have to have this more nuanced appreciation for what a guitarist can do as they're accompanying themselves. Mm-hmm. So if you listen to this song from 1929, you'll hear her play these kind of filigrees, these very detailed fills, these ornamental fills behind her husband. And it's just like astounding technique. Like, it's subtle. You almost wouldn't notice it. You have to be listening for it if you're not familiar with the recording. And she just was this phenomenal player, and you had this great song, and Zeppelin's like, okay, we'll take that lyric, and they built it up into something else entirely. But what they built it up into wasn't based around their songwriting chops. It was based around what they did in the studio.
Right. Because even this song, they only performed it live a couple times, because really they've worked so much, like, mastery into that recording that it was hard to pull off live, right?
They did it in 1975, and it doesn't sound as bad on bootleg as you would read about it sounding at the time. Like, it's not this complete mishmash. It's different.
Yeah.
But the studio production, it's almost like that Mancunian producer, Martin Hannett, and he would make bands like, we've talked about, Joy Division, sound a lot different in the studio.
Yeah.
And that's really what you have going on with the studio version by Zeppelin. It has this effect that you're not going to get many places where there's an echo, and we're all familiar with kind of like that echo studio recording technique, but what we're not so familiar with is the sound of the echo, like, it's reversed, so it's preceding the sound that it actually comes from. That's where you get this weird kind of dislocation of the track, and yet the vocal by Plant is constant. So you have this raga drone element of Eastern music, and that's what Zeppelin's going to get into come the mid-70s, when they're actually trying to do this on tour behind Physical Graffiti.
Mm-hmm.
And you have this swamp blues song of, like, a Slim Harpo. It's this very muddy sound befitting this element, this event that happened. It's literally dredging up, like, the riverbed and tossing it at the land. So it kind of is the sonic version of that.
It's really interesting to go back and listen to the original, the one that you're talking about there, when it was written in 1929, and then AB it with the Zeppelin one, specifically for, in one sense, specifically for arrangement. So when you hear the original, it's doing the kind of the expected blues progression that you expect from so many blues songs. And what Zeppelin did that I think is cool is it turned it into that droning thing that you talked about, where it's really just on that one chord forever, and it makes it so much, you said swampy, that's really the word that came to mind for me, and it makes it so unique in the way that they presented it, where it doesn't come across like just a blues cover. I think I love the way they did that part of it.
It's a big sound that Zeppelin has, and it does come out of that tradition. Like, people, I'm a King Bee baby, that was like a Slim Harpo song, so the Stones knew that, and it was this Louisiana swamp sound. But what Zeppelin's doing is they're injecting this, they're going back in time, but there's also this futuristic element to it. It sounds like something from a different plane of existence. And I think that's what makes it really the most successful Zeppelin sound. They would take the term arranger and use that synonymously with writer, so they arranged the song, like they arranged other songs, but it's also this modal song. So even though our ears wouldn't necessarily connect the two right away, it's not that far off from what Miles Davis was doing on Kind of Blue, where he's saying to people, okay, this is like a scale, and everything you play, you can play whatever you want, but it has to come off this scale. It was called modes. And this is sort of that idea, too, where it's off of that, like, that one, it's like that drone. It's off of that, but there's a lot of play. There's a lot of range that you can have where something is a drone, where we don't think of it maybe as an outright drone, but, for instance, The Who's I Can See for Miles, right? It's the same idea, but not as locked in. And it has that one-note guitar solo. That's all it is. It's just all of that sustain. There's a lot of sustain on this track, and it also sounds like it's almost going backwards against itself. Like, there's something a little off-kilter. Something's not quite
right.
Right.
Yeah.
You know how sometimes you go on YouTube and you hear something, and it's not like Universal Music hasn't put it there. Some guy like Ernie in Cleveland has put it there. And so to get around having it pulled down, he changes the speed like a little tiny bit, right?
Right.
And if you just like, I'm going to listen to Quiet Riot today, like, you don't really do it that much. Like, you're like, yeah, come on, feel the noise. Like, you don't really notice, right? But if you are someone who has a daily dosage of Quiet Riot.
Like, you're probably not listening to this podcast.
Yeah, and writes like labored tomes on Quiet Riot. Is always pitching liner notes. Like, you notice it right away.
Yes.
You can't even listen to it because it's off like that semitone or whatever.
Yeah.
That's how this recording is made to sound, like, deliberately.
That's good.
So that's a neat effect.
This is derailing us, but as somebody who grew up listening to CDs in the 90s, I mean, that's all I listened to in my car, is CDs, top audio quality. And now I'm on all these streaming services, and when I listen to songs through my phone, of new songs, it sounds fine. But anytime I listen to something that I originally heard on CD from the 90s, it sounds like a worse quality, because I know, I'm like, that is not as good as that should sound. I recognize it, which is a little bit to that. You talk about droning too, which made me think of what is it, Tomorrow Never Knows from the Beatles. That's another one. It just hangs on that one chord, and the fact that it's like, it's not wrong because it's perfect, but it's uncomfortable, and it's what you love about it is what makes it different, because it's staying on that one chord. You talked about the Stones and kind of alluded to this a little bit in I'm curious, do you think bands like the Stones and Zeppelin continued to pull from early songs and from, do you think they found, like, they found credibility in covering those old blues songs? Do you think they helped, were trying to shape their identity and shape, give themselves credibility by, like, saying that we are likened to these other artists that you respect and that we respect? Do you think there was an element of that?
With the Stones, to a degree, I think Zeppelin were just outright thieves who had a paucity of ideas. I like them, but I don't think they were very good. I just think that they had to come up with the shtick. I think that the band that Zeppelin grew out of, the Yardbirds, could absolutely paste. They could paste Zeppelin. They could play circles around them. They could write circles around them. Page performed better as a guitarist when he was with the Yardbirds, and he was, at best, their second best guitarist. Jeff Beck was a much better player. I think they relied a lot on bombast, and then they relied on things that 16-year-old boys would think are cool. And it's kind of like this cheap jack notion, very unnuanced, of sex and singing like a witch, and an idea of drumming that people talk about John Bonham. I find it pretty rudimentary. I think that his drums work on When the Levee Breaks because of the production. But if you listen to the fills that someone like a Keith Moon could play on The Kids Are All Right or The Overture of Tommy, there's no comparison between the two. You have volume, certainly, with Bonham, but technically, I think, it's like I said before, I think he was a teenage boy's idea of a great drummer. So the Stones, what they did is they were learning their craft. And Jimmy Page had been around for a while when Zeppelin happened, right? He's this ace session musician. He's in the Yardbirds. He had been invited into the Yardbirds at another point. He's like, no, I don't want to do that. But eventually, he relents. And for a while, they have this dual guitar lineup, which must have been crazy, of Beck and Page. And then Beck's like, I don't want to do this. Page takes over. They become this quasi-metal group, and they actually had Dazed and Confused in the Yardbirds, although it was called I'm Confused at the time. Yeah. And early Zeppelin, if you there's a bootleg out there. It's on YouTube from The Whiskey in early 1969. And they do this really cool cover of For Your Love, which you just wouldn't expect Zeppelin would be able to pull off, or even want to pull off. Like, you wouldn't think that would be something they'd be desirous of having in their wheelhouse. Mm. And the Stones were learning their craft. They were learning how to write songs. They learned from a lot of these American black artists. But I don't think the Stones, although they thought it was cool to be playing these songs, and they were like, it's like the kid on the block who has like the new Star Wars toy before everyone else. That's kind of what the Stones were in England. Those records were hard to get, and it was cool, and they loved them, and I think they were passionate about that. But then they eventually realized that they could do their own thing, too. And the Beatles helped them with that, with a the nudge there.
Right.
Page had been around for a while. So we're talking late 68. Mm-hmm. That's when, like, Zeppelin starts coming together. There's a bootleg from 68 at Gonzaga, which is about the earliest recording they have. And he's just cribbing stuff. He's just filching from these people. Hmm. I think that's so late in the game to be like, this is my credibility. Hmm. Because now you're at the end of the 60s. And the credibility thing was what you were doing in 62 and 63. And it's not what you're doing at this point. Because everybody's crossed over, right? Hendrix is huge. Like, all of that's happening now. Yeah. Black blues artists are playing on bills, right?
Right.
At the Fillmore. So it wasn't a credibility thing anymore. These were your peers. And you were just lifting stuff blatantly from your peers. And like, hey, we arranged that. That's ours.
And they've been to court many, many times over several of these songs, a ton of these songs. But it is just, it's outright thievery, as you said, on so many Zeppelin songs. For people that...
Well, one of the court... It was like Spirit, right? Like, Spirit's always taking them to court. For that's like a white band, like Stairway to Heaven. So that's kind of, that stuff like John Lennon lifted, right? Run for Your Life. That comes from an old Elvis, a couplet from it comes from Baby Let's Play House by Elvis, one of the great Sunsides. That kind of thing doesn't really bother me. And you know what? In some ways, thievery doesn't really bother me. What I have a larger issue with is that there's not enough meat on the bone for me to call something art when it's threadbare that way. I need richness of idea. I need that kind of like protean hugeness. Mm. And I don't really get that with Zeppelin. I listen to Zeppelin and like I know the Live on Blueberry Hill. It's a great bootleg, and they have this show from Vancouver in 1970. It came out, one of the earliest bootlegs, called Mudslide, which is really good. Hmm. But Zeppelin around the time, especially of like after Led Zeppelin III. So before, like in their earliest shows, I mentioned that For Your Love performance, they're really kind of like a jazz band. They would actually play jazz festivals, which is cool.
That is cool.
It's when the song, because then they're like, you don't know what you're going to get at the Zeppelin show. And they just toured the U.S. like 8 times in 1969. You didn't know what you're going to get. They're improvising, and it was exciting.
Hmm.
You settle into this kind of like with Led Zeppelin IV, which wasn't even its like actual name. It's what everyone calls it.
Yep.
You get kind of this slog and this sort of quasi-prog rock. And I think that's when things really get less fresh.
Hmm. As far as the entire album?
If you saw them like in concert, it's when you're getting like these versions of songs that go on for like an endless period of time.
Those wear me out.
And it's not that I have the problem with the length. It's just that, like, Page, sometimes he feels to me like a guitarist who is just, like, trying to impress someone in the front row. Like, hey, baby. And there's, like, a kind of, like, Keith Richards could be a sloppy player, right?
Yeah.
But when he was sloppy, there could still be, like, risk and tension in the slop. With Page, it just feels kind of shoddy. Mm. Like, he's just, I missed some notes. I'll make it up later. We're going on here for like 20 minutes. And I think it just, it became kind of rote. And to me, in all of their catalog, that's why When the Levee Breaks is this song that's like this crystallization moment in the studio where they did something so sonically fresh. Mm-hmm. And you look at something like Stairway to Heaven, it's kind of a silly concept. It's like, again, an eighth grader's idea of something really romantic, and you're like slow dancing with the girl. But you listen to it, it's like, what is this even? What's going on here? What is this trying to convey to me? There's kind of like there's a sorcery to it, which is appropriate with Paige, but it's kind of like this romantic bait and switch, and when you get older, you realize that maybe not quite as much as you thought is actually there.
Man, this feels like we're railing on Led Zeppelin. But they deserve it, I feel like, in a lot of ways. But they're awesome. They're still awesome, right? I
like them a lot. But then again, I'm a guy who, when Alf comes on, I enjoy watching it. I don't think Alf is that good. Like, I wouldn't, like, put that in the time capsule for the Martians on Neptune.
Great.
Like, you need to... Here we have Beethoven's Late String Quartet. And Alf, like, I wouldn't do that. I mean, I was like Perfect Strangers, but like, I think the thing
back.
Is,
this is great.
People can take this kind of assessment very personally. Like, you're knocking them, and the thing that, frankly, allows me to do it is I'm going to know more about the given subject than another person is going to, because they're thinking like, "Oh, Mudslide! I haven't heard of that. I need to go check that out." And with the whiskey in January, like I know my stuff, and I enjoy Zeppelin a lot, and I've always enjoyed collecting Zeppelin and downloading Zeppelin. I was listening to that Gonzaga recording I mentioned just the other night. It had nothing to do with this. I don't even think we'd spoken about this in a while by that point. But it's just, they're a great sort of like gateway band.
Yeah, that's
and
a good
they're
way to
good
put
because
it.
they get you back. I mean, look, I like really bad music at first when I was like a mid-teen. I'm thinking like, wow, Great White, they rock. Like, Great White doesn't rock. Like, they might do something, but like, rocking's really not it. And then I like moved on to Def Leppard, and Def Leppard's like, we like Led Zeppelin. And then you hear something like Black Dog, and it's exciting. And but that also got me to other things as well. And I think one thing, too, that Zeppelin's done, especially when people were less lazy, tend to be very lazy now. But there was a time when whoever you really liked as a group, you would get into who they liked.
Mm-hmm.
I think people do a lot less of that now.
Yeah.
It used to be just what everybody did.
Right.
And ironically, to do it at one point, you had to work to do it. You had to go to the used record store and hang out there and talk to the guy. Now, it's literally at your fingertips.
Yeah.
And yet, it seems that we don't really do that. So that is disheartening to me. But Zeppelin was a band that doubtless got people into Memphis. Many, for one, really
cool
people. Yeah, and there's a value in that. It's not like their music doesn't have value, but it's not the end-all, be-all of rock and roll that... Like, the level of sophistication between something like A Day in the Life and whatever Zeppelin did, like, you can't really compare that.
No.
Right, yeah. So, that's all I'm saying.
I get it. And I think, you know, for me, and somebody recently, like, left a comment, and it was a negative. It was like, why are you guys bashing the Eagles on this podcast we did on the Eagles? And it was like, for me, as a music fan, I'm not bashing something just in the way, like right now as we're talking about it. I don't hear anything that you're saying as an outright bash on Led Zeppelin. Like, I think a band has to hold its weight and be able to take the to be able to scrutinize something closely and say, well, here's what's good about it, and here's what's bad about it, and here's why it's still worth talking about. So, like, for me to be able to talk about a band in positive and negative terms just means that they're being put under the microscope and to see if it stands up. So I love talking like this about bands.
This is a relatively new phenomenon, I would say. That, like, for instance, once I wrote a piece about something about the Beatles. It wasn't the Let It Be one that I did recently. It was before that. Although this recent one mentioned that. And I said that Let It Be was arguably the Beatles' worst album. Now, unless you're an artist where, like, everything is kind of a qualitative piece, and there just aren't many artists that have ever been that way, then something has to, like, arguably finish last.
Right.
And, like, when you look at the Beatles' output, you can make fun dark horse arguments for Beatles for Sale or Please Please Me as their best album. Like, it's fun. But there's some you just absolutely can't do it for, right? You can't do it for Let It Be. It can be, like, a great album. It can be one of the best albums of all time. But you can't really make that dark horse argument for that. I got death threats from, like, these old hippies.
What?
Like, peace and love. And it's like, and they're attacking me. And there isn't anyone on earth who knows as much about the Beatles as I do. And that's backed up on my site. That's backed up in my work. Anyone can go and check that out for themselves and be like, oh, wow, he wasn't actually just lying on that podcast. That's true. And it's like, you're attacking someone. That's how people tend to view that, because I think we've become so insecure now. And we view it as something that is some sort of slight on us.
Yes.
And we get insecure. Like, we were going to do... And we're not. We were going to do that podcast on the animals.
The animals,
and
yep.
Work Song and Inside Looking Out. And I loved when you said, I was really interested when you said, I'll do it if it helps you out, but, like, I really, this one, it's I'm not feeling it. Because I just thought, like, what reason could someone have not to feel that? I love that. I didn't think, like, well, that's it for Ryan. I'm going to... What can I work him into a piece I'm doing and attack him? It never entered. I thought it was really interesting, and that would enhance your unenjoyment of that music. Would potentially enhance my
interesting.
Not like, because it's like I'm countervailing. Like,
yeah.
Oh, I have to make it up in the positive end. But, like, people do it oftentimes, like, for shtick. They say Revolver's a bad album because they want attention or whatever it is.
Yeah.
You know when someone has their motives in the right place.
Right.
And when they've done their homework and it's something that they can be fond of.
Mm-hmm.
You can be, the thing that you're really fond of or that you like the most, that's not synonymous with the best.
Mm-hmm.
And we often do that.
True.
Right. If it's your favorite band, it's the best band ever. You go to, like, the holiday party, and people are lecturing me on how Rogue One's the best film ever. It's like, I mean, come on. it's not. It might be, like, your all-time favorite film, but that's different. So Zeppelin's kind of like one of my key examples for this sort of thing. But of course, we're not bashing them at all.
Right. Well, I appreciate that. And I did appreciate, you know, so to fill in everybody else, you and I had a back and forth on the animals, and you're like, let's talk about this song. And you sent me some great clips. And it's the first time I was like, can we talk about something else? And the reason is I'm trying to make sure that I am excited about the thing that we're talking about, or else I feel like it comes through if I'm not. And so I was trying to, you know, listen to that, inward feeling of, all right, well, maybe we talk about something else. I'm not against the animals, to people listening. I'm not against the animals, but I wasn't feeling it. But now you're making me want to go and reevaluate. So I'm going to go re-listen and give them another shot.
To be honest with you, one of the reasons I thought that was so good, the song that, by the way, listeners, we were talking about is called Inside Looking Out by the Animals. And it's like this proto heavy metal song from the group who did House of the Rising Sun. And you really wouldn't expect that from them. And they did another version of it called Work Song, which is like a plantation, like a work song type of in the field sort of thing. And it goes back, and there's a jazz version of this. See, the thing that you like to do on this podcast is really dissect the song and its origins and everything. And some songs lend themselves to that treatment really well, where they come from a different place and they cross-pollinate genres and that type of thing. So that was kind of my thinking there.
I get it. And it is a good story. So maybe that will be a future one. We'll see. Let's talk about something that you brought up briefly, and that was the idea. This is something that me and my guitar buddies talk about. We get together and talk about music, and there's the argument of skill versus execution. And sometimes, okay, so if I'm going to have to choose between hearing Jeff Beck play a solo versus hearing Kurt Cobain play some power chords, I'm going to choose Kurt Cobain. And I think a lot of that has to do with, you know, just personal preference. Obviously, Kurt Cobain was nowhere the guitar player, nowhere near the guitar player that Jeff Beck was. And this comes into play in so many different ways. But something you brought up was John Bonham. All right, so John Bonham's drumming on this song, it really defines the song. I mean, it starts. You hear the first second of it, and you're like, that's when the levee breaks. It's this epic, huge moment. But the actual drum part, like you said, is not hard. I mean, I'm not a good drummer, but I can play that part, but I can't make it sound like John Bonham. And I remember hearing, I think it was G.E. Smith, was that it? The lead guy on the SNL band made some quote about Kurt Cobain at one point, and he was like, that kid can play guitar. And that's from the guy who's like the lead guitar player on a television show who was an excellent guitar player. But there's an interesting element there. In people, and Ringo's kind of the same for me. Nobody is going to say Ringo's the best drummer in the world, but to me, he's one of the best in that he served the song, so he got out of the way of the songwriting. But I'm intrigued on the way that John Bonham drummed on this song that made it so epic sounding, and the way that they recorded it. Do you know anything about the way they recorded that with the mics and all that?
Yeah, and it's almost like some early version of like the loop concept, right?
Yeah.
Where it's like this over mic sort of the Stone Roses' Fool's Gold has this drum part and also a loop drum part, and they kind of fuse together. That's why it can sound a little, or it did in 1990, a little naked on stage. And you mentioned like the degree of difficulty with the drum part. It's very, and we don't normally like connect the two, but it's very Wall of Sound, this production. It's very kind of like Ronettes, Phil Spector, like mid-1960s. That's like those were these teenage symphonies, right? For like girl sleepovers type of things. Mm-hmm. And that's not Led Zeppelin have a different kind of sleepover that they're after type of deal. But when you think about the Wall of Sound, it's very much there's a lot going on, right? There's violins, all of that. But it's very much a drum thing. Like, when you go Wall of Sound, you go Wagnerian, and you get these big drums. So that's what anchors this song. And by anchors, I mean, that's what really roots us in that kind of modal concept. And then everything can swirl around. It's like a storm cloud coming into your town. There's all this energy in the cloud. And yet there's like this one constant in it. And that's going to be the voice. And Plant would often sing in that super high register. And I think he can sound a little ridiculous when he does that.
Yep.
Black Dog is what you get. But he's not doing that here. I think this is a key component of the song that's always overlooked. The song is a different song without it. It's his harmonica.
Man.
You don't think of Zeppelin, right? It's like ever having harmonica. Do you? Like you would, I mean, off the top of your head, can you even like, oh, the harmonica on that other song?
No.
But you really can't even think of it.
And
like,
it's Plant
you can do it
playing
with,
it. He's the one playing. I had to look it up. I was like, is that him? Because that's really good. It's him.
Yeah, it comes out of, now they would have been harmonica fans.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you were a blues fan, certainly Howlin' Wolf, harmonica, and especially Little Walter. Little Walter is kind of, in my view, the harmonica inspiration on this song, because he played the harmonica with this huge, beefy tenor saxophone, electrified, though, tone. And that's exactly this tone that Robert Plant gets with studio help on this. And it's sort of the harmonica that animates that sludge component. So it's not just sludge. It sort of makes the earth and the loam dance. And it's very ghost-like harmonica, right? Yeah. It's like kind of almost from one of those scary 1930s Disney Halloween instruments where like the ghosts are shimmering and everything. You can always envision this harmonica playing along to that. So that to me is crucial as even the drums.
Hmm. And it's interesting looking at the, you know, the rest of the album, because, you know, Led Zeppelin 4, there's so many, most of the songs are guitar driven. Most of them are riff based, right? Black Dog, Rock and Roll, Stairway to Heaven. This song, you notice Page in there with the slide and he's doing cool stuff, but he's not the focus. And I think that's something else that distinguishes it from other Zeppelin songs is he's in the background. He is not the number one focus in this song. I think that's cool, something that makes it cool.
I'd say on Rock and Roll that's another one where you could say that the drums are kind of a lead instrument, right?
Yeah,
it's sort of a tandem between the guitar riff, but that tumbling drum pattern, like, in other words, that song has a drum riff.
Mm-hmm.
When you think, like, you think that there's always going to be a drum riff because there's a beat and the beat is constant, but there isn't usually a drum riff,
right?
Like, there are some throughout Rock and Roll, like Get Off of My Cloud by the Rolling Stones, that's a drum riff, right?
Yeah.
That's the central, that's what's holding that together. Rock and Roll is that way, but yeah, it is a lot of guitar. It's not as like guitar driven as the riffs on Led Zeppelin 2, right? I mean, everything is guitar, even though you have Moby Dick and you have like the big solo. But Moby Dick, until the guitar solo is like a guitar, or until the drum solo is a guitar riff.
Mm.
There's like a lot of, and then Led Zeppelin 3 is the one where they're like, okay, let's unplug, let's do some acoustic.
Yep.
Yeah, so that's going to be a guitar record in a different way. And then, to me, Led Zeppelin 4, it's sort of a hodgepodge album, right? Like, it's not a consistent, not that you have to have the same sound from track to track, but there's not like a prevailing theme. We talk about like Revolver, and it's like, this is a lot of variation from song to song. But there is this prevailing theme of English folk music meeting American rhythm and blues.
Yeah.
A radical concept at the time. This one is sort of all over the place, right? You get like the J.R. Tolkien stuff. You have kind of like the updated blues of Black Dog, which if someone said to you like Black Dog was this song from like the 1920s and they gave it the Zeppelin treatment, you wouldn't be surprised, right? Like it's even the lyric is kind of what you'd expect with that sort of Charlie Patton hoodoo. And then at the end of it, you have this bad boy waiting for you, which is really, I mean, there really isn't, even their other songs that are heavily produced, like Kashmir, there's nothing in their entire catalog that suggests that they're going to be able to do something like this.
That's true. And it's interesting to go back and listen to, there's the version on Coda, and it's called If It Keeps On Raining, and it doesn't have half the magic. There's none of the magic, honestly. I mean, like, the Plant is even singing the vocal with a slightly different melody, and it's like, get me back to the other. And it was recorded, the version on Coda was recorded before the one on Led Zeppelin 4, but for people listening, if you haven't heard it, it's really fascinating to go back and listen and be like, man, I'm so glad they gave it another shot for Led Zeppelin 4 to get it right, because it really sounds so unique.
They had to figure it out. That's the thing I like about this, too. They obviously had to work at this.
Yes.
This was not like an easy sort of thing, like, okay, we have this hot lick, and let's just flesh it out and put in some things about, like, kind of girls who might be old enough and might not be, which is what they did a lot of the time. They had to work for this song.
Mm-hmm.
And when you get to the guitar solo in it, and I think this is it's subtle, but it's a very efficacious technique. This wouldn't work as well if the guitar solo went off in all these different directions, right? Like, even the guitar solo at the end of Stairway to Heaven, which is a great guitar solo. It's like a really high level of playing.
Yeah.
It's veering off. It's going off and doing its thing. Here, the guitar solo, like, he reins in the ego enough to say, okay, my guitar solos in this song, they will be built off of the melody that's already being played.
Yeah.
And what he then does is he embellishes with the slide.
Yeah.
But he's playing, the solos are the melodies. Like, when you think about early guitar solos from the Beatles, not all of them, but, like, I should have known better. There's a guitar solo. It's Harrison playing the melody that you've been hearing of the song. Like, there's not, like, really anything new to that, and it can work. But Zeppelin didn't normally do that. Page didn't normally do that.
Yeah.
He wanted to have, like, this big new statement. So I've always found it interesting that he was okay to sort of feed over his ego to what made the track work best. You mentioned Ringo Starr. It's kind of like Jimmy Page's Ringo Starr moment on guitar in Zeppelin.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it serves the song so much better by the fact that he didn't pull out guitar heroics.
But a lot of the reason he could do that is because of the tone, because of the that coloratura he's getting from that slide, that heavy electrified slide. He knows he has a good thing with that tone, and that's going to carry the day.
Yeah.
That's all he needs. And then to just keep hammering that riff. You mentioned Tomorrow Never Knows. Tomorrow Never Knows is going to be however long it's going to be, 3 minutes or whatever. This is going to swell, right? What are we up to, like, over 7 minutes?
Yeah.
And I don't think you could really take Tomorrow Never Knows and make it much longer than it is, and it would cease to work as well. You'd be like, okay, enough. This is kind of repetitive. It's annoying. This, to its credit, and this is cool about this song, and it's kind of ironic that it's by Zeppelin, it never gets repetitive. Like, it's as long as it should be.
Yeah.
You're never like, all right, let's wrap this up, boys, to move on. Like, nor do you think, like, I wish this went on another 10 minutes. It's just sort of perfect that way.
It is perfect that way. Ah, man. Colin, I love talking music with you, and it was great talking Led Zeppelin. I love that you love and can examine the good and bad about them as well, which is one of my favorite things. So for everybody listening, please go follow Colin on Twitter. It's at Colin Fleming Lit, and as well as his website, colinflemminglit.com. I'll put links to those in the show notes. Colin, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for coming on today.
Okay, thank you, sir.
Thank you for listening to the Songs of Note podcast. Be sure and subscribe so you don't miss an episode. See you next time.